Good morning. You are tuned in to CKLN 88.1, and it's time for the International Connection. This is show number 24 in a series on mind control, each Sunday morning from 9:30 to 10:30 here on CKLN. Today we're going to be hearing part two of an interview with Dr. Stephen Kent, a professor of sociology at University of Alberta in Edmonton. We talk about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, ritual abuse and cults, and allegations against Freemasons' involvement in group sexual abuse of children. Later in today's show, we'll hear coverage of a ritual abuse conference that Stephen Kent spoke at in Thunder Bay and in 1994. But first, this second half of the Stephen Kent interview.
Interesting debates or developments in the False Memory Syndrome Foundation about the issue of early confirmation. What's so extraordinary about False Memory Syndrome Foundation is that the debates swirl around a number of high-powered academics. The founders were PhDs. He was math professor. She was a professor in an educational related field. The daughter is a PhD psychology professor at Oregon. Right. As these debates swirled, the brother of the father who was co-founder of False Memory Syndrome Foundation, wrote a letter saying that he suspected the allegations of child abuse in the household were true. So I mean, it's not definitive proof, but here you have one family member speaking out against another in support of the adult's alleged victim. Very, very complicated issues about verification. Probably the most complicated story about verification comes in the context of the McMartin School debate. Mm-hmm. The McMartin School case is one that both sides in this debate use as verification of the accuracy of their accounts. As you know, a number of children came forward with ritual abuse accounts in a nursery or day school run by the Buckey family. A mother and son were indicted, I think the largest trial in California history.
This is in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm. And they got off. Son was retried, and he got off. Now, one of the factors that prevented conviction was what sounds like very sloppy interviewing techniques on the part of a key therapist. Nonetheless, the kids had made allegations that there were tunnels under the school. Police dug and didn't find tunnels. Now, this is very damning evidence from law enforcement perspective and from a jury. Kids say there are tunnels. You look for them, you don't find them. There's problems. Well, in the midst of the second trial, this property, the school had been sold. It was about to be bulldozed, torn down, and parents hired a private archaeologist to do last-minute digs. And sure enough, he found tunnels. He found the very, very tunnel-like structures that the children had been talking about. And one tunnel led into a building next door to the daycare center, which is also similar to what the children had in their accounts. He found a bag, a plastic bag that had a copyright date on it, I believe from 1986, which indicated that these tunnels had been filled with dirt sometime after 1986. So he had evidence of tunnels, and evidence that tunnels had been filled in recently with dirt and various debris, but that evidence never came up in the trial itself. So, you know, once again, it's a very complicated case where therapists probably did a bad job of interviewing. Police may have done a very bad job of investigating because it took a private individual to find the tunnels. The evidence never wound up in court.
And since you brought it up, what is your opinion on the False Memory Syndrome Foundation in terms of the work they're doing? What do you think the effects they've had on the field of dealing with this abuse?
Some of the so-called science the False Memory Syndrome Foundation has advocated is bogus.
In terms of false memory syndrome itself?
The bottom line is that if they've served a positive function at all, it is to make therapists and counselors much more rigorous about the kinds of interviewing techniques that go on. But much of what the foundation has advocated goes certainly beyond science and enter into the realm of literal harassment. The kinds of unprofessional and undignified, but that's probably not a term a social scientist should use, but certainly unprofessional interventions that the mother used against the daughter when she was up for promotion hearings, you know, writing letters against her on false memory syndrome foundation letterhead, is beyond the pale of anything that should go on in a scientific context. It's a family tragedy as well, but it shows that the group is not merely committed to objective science, but is also objected to or committed to a kind of ideological advocacy that often dismisses contrary facts. It's a moreover, part of the danger of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is that it very cleverly coined this term, false memory syndrome, which if you talk to people in the mental health community is a misrepresentation of what a syndrome actually is. So it's got it's put into legal context and cultural context a very catchy word that may actually misrepresent the delicacy with which science is trying to get at some of these memory issues. Moreover, I've got a particular problem with at least one section of a book that a False Memory Syndrome Foundation person wrote. Richard Offshee co-authored a book, Making Monsters, and he's involved with a board of directors. I believe he's on the board of directors.
The advisory board.
Offshee was involved in a satanic abuse allegation case in Olympia, Washington. This is a famous Paul Ingram case. Ingram was, I believe, the third-ranking highest cop in the Olympia, Washington police force. His daughters and wife were coming forward with allegations about sexual assault and abuse. And some of those allegations shaded into satanic ones. He got arrested, and his arrest was really quite disturbing to the Olympia, Washington police. It was the body of the guys who arrested him.
They brought
in Richard Offshee because they knew of his work with so-called cults. What they didn't realize, too, is that Offshee had worked with allegations of a forced police confessions. From spending time with the cops, Offshee got suspicious that they may have been leading Paul Ingram through their questions, and so when Offshee met Ingram, on the spur of the moment, he created what literature at the time called, in quotes, a, quote, little experiment, unquote. That is to say, he made up a story, gave it to Ingram, and then waited to see whether Ingram would create memories around the story. The trouble is, the story that he made up was close enough to what he had been saying that it could have been true, or at least elements could have been true. When Offshee reaches the point of writing the book Making Monsters, when he describes this, quote, little experiment, it becomes an experiment. That is to say, he misrepresents the hunch or the spur of the moment's poorly designed and poorly implemented query that he initiates and elevates it to the level of a scientific experiment. I think he misrepresents what he did. And in fact, when a judge was ruling upon one aspect of the case, the judge dismissed Offshee's little experiment for being unprofessional in design. So, you know, there's a lot about the book one could discuss, but in terms of a sociological comment, that borders on, well, I think it goes beyond bordering on misrepresentation about what happened.
Mm-hmm. What do you know any information about some of the other people on the False Memory Syndrome Foundation's advisory board?
I do know a bit about Ralph Underwager. Now, you've probably gotten the Underwager story from many people, but Underwager was an expert in hundreds of cases, a so-called expert in hundreds of child abuse cases, always on the side of the defense. That is to say, Underwager would be the person who would claim methodological difficulties in children's accounts, would claim children were too young to know the difference between right and wrong, between lying and telling the truth. He would try to punch holes in the prosecution's charges in a number of ways, and he was testifying in cases around the world. What finally happened, a couple of things happened on the Underwager. First, in a notorious case involving a repeated child abuser in Australia, Mr. Bubbles' case, the Australian equivalent to 60 Minutes just did a devastating critique on Underwager's alleged credentials. Around the same time, a New England group of social workers commissioned a study by a well-respected psychologist who's worked on child abuse, Anna Salter, and Salter systematically went through the research that Underwager and his wife Wakefield had published, and the Underwager Wakefield scholarship was abysmally bad. It misrepresented facts. It statistically, it was bad. It gave interpretations to minor points in major articles. It sometimes completely misrepresented the points of articles. Underwager essentially was not doing science. So Underwager as an expert got discredited in many places, although interestingly he still became an expert in the Martinsville, Saskatchewan case. More damaging perhaps to Underwager's reputation was that he gave an interview in a journal called Podiatry. It's a pedophile journal out of Europe. I think it's out of Holland.
Yes, it's out of Amsterdam.
In which he said very peculiar things about the supposed right of pedophiles to show love to children in the way that they wanted. Because of that Podiatry interview, Underwager was forced to resign. His wife, as far as I know, still stayed on the Foundation for False Memory Syndrome. One of the people on the board whom I know a little bit is Dr. Margaret Singer. Margaret Singer has had a long history of working with so-called controversial religions, groups of people called cults. She had testified on behalf of Patty Hearst back in the famous Patty Hearst trial in the mid-70s. Much of Margaret's work has been in the context of supporting parents, so that a significant strain of the so-called counter-cult movement, in which Margaret was intimately involved, was concerned helping parents reestablish contact, or if you will, get back their adult children who had converted to controversial religions. She had done some interviews with alleged satanic abuse people, was not convinced by them, but her involvement on this board seems to be part of her continuation of support for parents, a continuation that traces back through her involvement with the so-called cults and possibly even with the Hearst family itself. So she is a person on the board who I suspect is very well intentioned. But she's also supportive of the family. And what evidence I've read in print about the dynamics of the Fried family when the kids are growing up makes that family to be clearly dysfunctional. So I would question Margaret's judgment about her involvement, her support of the fried parents on this particular instance, you know, regardless of the kind of work she had done previously in fighting abuse in deviant religious contexts or therapeutic contexts.
Right. Are you familiar with Dr. Jennifer Fried's, this is the daughter of Pamela and Peter Fried, who founded the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. Dr. Jennifer Fried has written a book recently, Betrayed, and has a theory around that. Are you familiar with that, and what do you think of it?
I read it a long time ago. I really got a comment directly on it. I've got a graduate student who finished the book and is really quite impressed by it. What's impressive about what Jennifer's done is that she's taken her personal experiences and family tragedies and transformed them into research opportunities. I mean, many of us are in academics because it gives us a vehicle to get at engaging the world. It gives us a somewhat systematic and rigorous way to engage the world. And in her case, she's working on very complicated personal issues, but through the rigor of science. As far as the content goes, I haven't read the book, so you'll have to rely upon some other people to get specifics about the content and its accuracy.
Okay, we've been talking about cults and other organizations that are allegedly involved in ritual abuse. Can you name any of these groups?
Oh, now, the groups, I'm not sure about the groups you've been talking about. Let me say very generally that many of the controversial groups that I hear about are involved in patterned systematic abuse of their members, often children. Now, people always ask for names, and naming groups is very difficult because of issues about potential lawsuits and whatnot. I can talk about some of the published research that I've done, and I'm most comfortable talking about published research because this material is in the public realm already.
Okay.
I had done a study of the leader, the founder of a group called the Children of God, now called the Family, David Berg, because the group's doctrines had been highly sexualized. It was impossible to understand this group without appreciating the sexual content of its doctrines. The sexual content of its doctrines had come directly from its leader. I had published this, I had written this account. It had been accepted in a journal, Research in the Social Scientific Study of Religion, supposed to be published by JAI Press out of Greenwich, Connecticut. The Children of God, the Family, found out about the publication before it came out. It contacted a lawyer in California. The lawyer in California wrote a letter to the publisher, an academic who had not even read the piece, wrote a letter to the publisher. And a group representative himself wrote a letter to the publisher, all insisting that my article not be published. And none of them had even read it. The publisher, Herbert Johnson, did not have liability insurance for his company. And so, for fear of a possible lawsuit, he withdrew the article. I had the page proofs in my hand at this time. That's how close the piece was to coming out. What I had argued in the piece was that David Berg himself had gone through some unfortunate sexual experiences as a child, sexual experiences that took place in a very restrictive, abusive Christian environment. This was a Christian environment that was by no means healthy. This environment also involved the use of corporal punishment and so on. David Berg had a great deal of sexual confusion. This sexual confusion exploded into the theology that he developed when he gained control of a group in the late 60s, the Children of God. So in essence, Berg translated his sexual confusion into group theology. people could pretty much guess what I was going to argue from the title of the article. And so the group carried out academic censorship. Now, the article eventually got published, but the place where it published was far less prisoner. What we often find in cases of controversial religions that abuse is that these groups do not have independent monitoring agencies or bodies. That is to say, the places where abuse are most likely to happen are in independent religious organizations whose leadership controls any kind of overview agencies that might look at it, any kind of board of directors. Having said that, however, we know very clearly that there's been a long history of child abuse in churches that have this kind of hierarchical management. That is to say, we know about the cases of abuse in residential schools by Anglicans, the United Church, and of course the Catholic Church. What happens in these instances, at least what's happened certainly with the Catholic Church in this country and around the world, is that the organization becomes committed to preserving its own public image and preserving its own financial status. Moreover, in the Catholic Church, we've got pressures inside the organization to maintain the numbers of priests. There's a real problem in the North American Church about getting young North American men in the priesthood. So to open up practicing priests to investigations by external agencies threatens just sheer numbers, not to mention image, financial matters, and so on. So the Catholic Church in many ways has participated in cover-ups of early allegations of abuse. And the church very clearly now says these policies have changed. But every now and then you hear about very aggressive tactics that lawyers representing the church take towards clients. So by no means have we heard the last about the issues about abuse in mainstream religious organizations. And I've got concerns about abuses that may be going on in overseas communities where the public ability to gather information and discuss it is not nearly so well developed. That is to say, in North America, we have a press that, despite quite a number of unfortunate constraints on it, from time to time gets out very good stories. You know, the kind of work that you're doing now, where people talk about very controversial issues in a public forum. A lot of countries overseas don't have this kind of structures. I know on a number of the controversial groups that I study, groups that have headquarters in overseas countries or are ethnically based in overseas countries, many times children from North America wind up being sent to school overseas. When they get sent to these overseas schools, they often are separated from their parents, and they're working in environments that have few, if any, external controls. So the possibility of kids getting abused in these schools is much, much higher than it would be if kids operated in a public school system.
Now, I know you've spoken about the involvement of the Masonic Lodge in, or some members of the Masonic Lodge involved in allegations towards them of being perpetrators of ritual abuse. Can you talk about how you first received this information?
Well, early on in my research, when people were coming forward with accounts, some accounts appeared about deviant Freemasons. That is to say, some of the people making allegations were indicating that their fathers had been Freemasons, and that somehow their alleged abuse they thought was connected with the lodge or Freemasons. Occasionally, abuse accounts if they were true, and I can't say that they were definitively, but if they were true, seemed to have occurred inside Masonic lodges and so on, I was really quite perplexed by the appearance of Freemasonry in a fairly significant number of accounts. That is to say, I was not getting any allegations about other kind of philanthropic or civic groups. I was not getting accounts about Kiwanis or Lions Club or Knights of Columbus or Rotarians or whatnot. It was only allegations about deviants involving Freemasons, sometimes in Masonic lodges. And my sense all along is that even if some of these allegations are true, ordinary Masons would be appalled at the material that I was hearing. But nonetheless, I was faced with a dilemma of trying to make sense out of what I was hearing. So I undertook an investigation of Freemasonry. I had already published an encyclopedia about Freemasonry several years earlier in the second edition of the Canadian Encyclopedia. So I had some background. And what I found is that related to Freemasonry are countless splinter groups of these splinter groups involve usually just men. Sometimes women get involved in traditions involving high ceremonialism, elaborate rituals, and so on. So, for example, if one goes back a couple of generations, one can even find Masonic connections to a group like the Solar Temple. These are people who I often call them rich ritual junkies. They love the pomp and ceremonialism that they see in Freemasonry, but they want to go further with it. Freemasonry does not have a developed sense of a demonic figure in it. That is to say, there aren't these kind of rigid satanic versus God images that appear in Christianity. What I did find, however, was some mentions of Lucifer, but more importantly, a sense in some of the upper-level rituals that God was a threefold character, Jah-Bulah, Jah possibly referring to Yahweh, Bul referring to Baal, and so on. The Baal reference is a reference to pagan gods in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament gods who required child sacrifice. So, I mean, ordinary Masons would talk about the god Jah-Bulah and not really think too much about what they were saying, but it was plausible to me that Masonic deviants, these people I call ritual junkies, might see that in this god figure you combine both good and evil. You combine a higher god with a god who required child sacrifice. And so as part of my attempts to come up with a plausibility structure for why deviant Freemasons may be involved in these kind of allegations, I found a point of entry, you might say, in theology that would allow deviant practitioners to develop abusive rituals in the context of what they thought could be worship to a higher god.